Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today, Steve Hamm, is a veteran journalist who worked at Business Week and the San Jose Mercury News, among other places, and has made documentary films on immigration, policing, and opioids, written books about IBM's Watson AI system, and the use of data clouds. When an old colleague told him about the PIVOT project, an international effort to bring together a global group to think through new ways and strategies to help the world meet net zero emissions by 2050, he thought he would embed with the group as a journalist to write about their efforts to find consensus and solutions. Very quickly, though, he found himself sucked in by the work, which combines global equity issues with lessened CO2 emissions using system modeling, complexity theory, AI, and new thinking about resiliency. And Hamm very quickly went from a dispassionate observer to an active participant. He writes about the group's work to find answers to incredibly difficult questions and profiles some of the project's contributors that range from NGOs working on climate change for a number of years to activists, experts in sciences, in the humanities, faith leaders, even people who just think of themselves as global citizens. His book on their work is titled The Pivot, Addressing Global Problems Through Local Action. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Steve Hamm, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to meet you, Rich.
The Pivot Projects is kind of a grand idea of addressing global problems through a lot of different people from disparate industries and different practices, you know, everything from activists to data crunchers to faith leaders to people who've worked on climate change and urban development and rural development for a good part of their career. Tell us how you discovered the Pivot Projects. How did this start?
Well, it started actually with I got an alert from LinkedIn, which I'm a member of various social networking platforms. And I got an alert saying that a guy that I knew had just launched this crazy thing, and it was described as a post-COVID research project. And I was interested because I had worked with this fellow at IBM for 6 years. I've been a journalist most of my career, but there were 6 years when I was a storyteller for IBM. And he had been kind of the chief thinker for a project there called Smarter Cities and Smarter Planet. It was the idea of using technology and data analytics to make things work better, make the world work better. And so I saw this ping from him, and I said, oh, that's interesting. And I reached out to him and asked him what it was. And so he told me, and what it really is a global collaboration, you know, making use of all of our modern technologies, the internet. And it has a core idea, which I found intriguing from the beginning. And that is that if you combine kind of a diverse collective intelligence, a lot of people with different expertise and points of view, with something called systems thinking, and with technology tools, including AI research engines, collaboration platforms, things like that, you could help make the world more sustainable and resilient. And this emerged in the middle of COVID because COVID was a wake-up call. I think a lot of people have said this, you know, that the way we are living is not sustainable, and that, you know, we can have these global contagions that really upset society on a planetary scale. So that was the idea. And the idea was, well, how can we take these techniques, these ideas, these thinking tools that we have and try to address some of these big problems? And when I say sustainability and resilience, those are the main targets. You know, a lot of it's about the environment, about climate change and things like that. But there are many other elements that are related. And those would be economic equity issues, which are at the core of a lot of our social problems around the world and things like that.
Social equity, for that matter, too.
Absolutely. So, you know, it was launched, and I went in because, you know, I'm a journalist. I said, oh, can I come in and be an embedded journalist? You know, like the way, you know, in war, they have embedded journalists, you know, with the troops who can tell the story of how it goes and what the journey is like. So they, you know, obviously that's very attractive to them. And they said yes. And almost immediately after I went in, I said, you know, I think this is a book. I think this is it's not just a quick little thing. This is a journey. It's a longer story. So I approached my publisher. My last publisher of my last book was at Columbia University Press. that one was called Smart Machines, and it was about artificial intelligence and how it impacts society. So I went to them, and they showed great interest in this. And out of that came the pivot, addressing global problems through local action.
You write at the very beginning of the book, you know, I started out embedding in the project as a dispassionate observer, and soon enough you became, you said, my role changed from observer to a participant chronicler. Yeah. What happened on this journey that moved you out of the traditional journalist role of watching and reporting to being a part of the work itself?
Well, it was gradual because I'm used to kind of having a line, making lines. And of course, you know, there are different kinds of journalists. So there's kind of straight, he said, she said journalism of a daily newspaper article, you know, the facts and opinions about it. And then there's, you know, forms of journalism that are more analytical and even some that kind of plant a hypothesis and examine it, those kinds of things. So there are lots of different ways. But I, at first, you know, very kind of standing back watching, but then people would call on me in meetings, you know, we had all these Zoom meetings. And I would say, well, you know, I don't really want to interfere with what you guys are saying, but originally it was kind of like feedback. But then it became more like, hey, here are my ideas. And I've always been a bit of an environmentalist. I love the outdoors and things like that. So, you know, I have read a lot about climate science, and I understand as an amateur, not an amateur, you know, I mean, I'm not an expert in it, but I was convinced quite a while ago that climate change is a serious matter. We don't know exactly how it will go, but it's very likely to have profound impacts on the world. And we're better off starting to try to understand it and adapt to it and deal with it now rather than later. So I went into it with that point of view, but also as a journalist. And then gradually over time, I felt after I finished the book, and this is an important point because I did the whole book kind of in my journalist role. And then I said to myself, well, you know, this is fascinating. I love it. I love these people. Let me continue. And I gradually got deeper and deeper involved and more influential on it. So, you know, now I'm totally into it. And I feel like that our climate problems, our social problems are so acute right now. They're both acute and chronic. And we can't just kind of stand back and let others act. We have to act. So I mean, I issue a call. I'm now an evangelist. My call is it's time to pivot, and it's time for society, for communities to pivot to become more sustainable and resilient. And it's time for individuals to become climate activists. We can't be bystanders.
Tell us a little bit about the three initial leaders. You mentioned Colin Harrison, who worked at IBM on Smarter Cities and that initiative. Peter Head is a CEO of the Ecological Sequestration Trust in the UK and really worked on a lot of UN panels. Rick Robinson is a city planner in London. Of course, they've done a lot of work on sustainability in the last few years. Tell us about these three people. How did they get together and how did they envision this group coming together?
Well, Colin and Rick knew each other because Rick was at IBM for years, and he was very much involved in the Smarter Planet and Smarter Cities strategy, and Colin was kind of like the thought leader for that. So they knew each other, and the IBMers knew Peter Head because Peter Head used to be the head of AirUp, which is AirUp is a big global engineering firm, and they hired him years ago to create their first integrated practice. And by that, I mean engineering, design, consulting, they saw the big development projects, whether they're bridges or cities, as something that has to be addressed holistically. You can't just say, oh, this is a piece of physical infrastructure, we're just going to build it and not worry about all of the other things around it. We have to take a systems view of it. So he was running that. And so the guys knew each other from that. And it was Colin who reached out to Peter, Rick, and others with an email and got a lot of people involved. And the initial people were very much kind of engineering, computer science, systems change oriented. But they, you know, it's interesting. They were diverse people. They knew lots of other kinds of people. And quickly, other people were drawn in who were very different. There was a very large group of faith leaders or faith-oriented people. There was education people. There was innovation people, arts, and just a wonderful collection of people. And I would say, you know, early on, as these things tend to be, a lot of white males from the Northern Hemisphere. But there was a tremendous amount of trying to get other voices and other faces. And we had some wonderful young people. I'll mention a couple. Shulamit Morris Evans, a British, I think she was an au pair when she joined, but she was also a very serious student. And a member of, you know, kind of a, I would say, an activist, a climate activist in the United Kingdom. And, you know, there have been people who've been involved early, who stuck with it, others have left. Another woman I'll mention is Paola Bay, an Italian artist and fashion designer who designed shoes, you know, in the past. I mean, it's a really interesting group of people. And it was the bringing together of these diverse points of view that really made it fascinating and new, I would say, because, you know, getting a bunch of engineers together or city planners together, you know, they know each other. That's a club that's out there. But I think this was a different sort of club, much more diverse.
My guest today is Steve Hamm, a business journalist, author, and filmmaker. His new book is titled The Pivot, Addressing Global Problems Through Local Action. And he talks about the Pivot Projects, which is a group of people from all across a wide range of life, activists, data crunchers, faith leaders, engineers, governmental planners, and the like, that are looking to find ideas that can contribute to 2050 net zero emissions, as well as the UN Right. Sustainable Development Goals. So you bring all these people together, some people who have had lots of conversations amongst themselves, bringing in other people who have maybe had other conversations amongst themselves. They haven't all talked together. Explain what that experience was. It sounds like it would be lots of discussion.
Oh, yeah, to a fault. You know, the initial task for the group was to get, there were like 20 work groups. And people, you know, this is all voluntary. So people would join the work groups, and the task they were given was to kind of think through the topic of the work group. And it might be, it might be health. It might be COVID and global health. It might be arts and culture. It might be faith. It might be water, you know, and wastewater. And, you know, the whole range from nuts and bolts to very lofty. And so these groups would get together, kind of discuss, well, what do we think is important? What kind of pivot could we anticipate? And the other thing they did that I thought was very important was a very nuts and bolts task of building a system. And systems thinking is this idea that if you're going to solve a problem, you can't just see the problem as some narrow thing. You have to understand all the elements that are part of a larger system that influence or are entangled with that problem. You build a highway across the Bronx in the middle of New York, you have to think about, well, what are you doing to the neighborhoods that you're severing one from another? You know,
right.
So that highway project across the Bronx was part of what destroyed the Bronx, right? But people don't anticipate these things, right?
Right now in our community, we're looking at the fact of the interstate system bisected the African-American historic community and the business district.
Yeah.
And even now, 60 years later, you know, the debate is, do we move the highway to try to recreate something that was lost, or is it a symbol of equity? Or there's a whole lot of range of opinions on that. But this is something, the idea of doing something in a vacuum has disastrous consequences somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. So there happens to be a wonderful technology tool called KUMU, K-U-M-U. And that is a visualization tool that's basically designed to help you define a system and understand the interlinking and interoperating elements in it. So each of the groups made a KUMU of their system. And I guess the first phase was a lot of talking, and then a lot of crazy KUMU designing, and then some reports written on these topics. And that was kind of like phase one. And phase two was really, well, how do we take these ideas and now engage with communities? And the initial idea was the group would kind of drop in like a consulting group, or we'll come in and help a community kind of design an intervention or come to grips with a problem. And the problem with that, the main problem with that, was all these communities were involved with COVID, and had that was just occupying the government leaders totally. So that kind of model didn't really develop. But what really did develop was people from Pivot Projects, either individually or in groups, going into situations and going into communities and helping out in ways that could be useful. And in some cases, they were physical communities. In other cases, they were large collaborations that were like Pivot Projects, but different goals and things like that. But one thing I want to mention, I think this might be of special interest to your audience there in Oklahoma, is one of the key ideas that came out of Pivot Projects thinking was there was the idea of something called the cellular economy. You know, we're all very used to the capitalist system. It's very mature. It's been developing as a thing, I would say, for about 200 years, probably since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, it's pretty mature at this point, and it's pretty dominant in much of the world. But it's also very, you know, the power is, it concentrates power and concentrates wealth. So the idea was, well, is there an alternative that could spread power and spread ideas and spread, you know, and give more people, empower more people to be innovative and to take action in their communities and to be influential? And the idea was the cellular economy. Small groups of people and communities come up with ideas, grassroots, use innovative technologies or innovative ideas, and kind of have interventions, redesign, you know, the city, change the way things work. You've probably heard of the idea of the 15-minute city, where you can either walk or take a bus, or, you know, everything you need is within walking distance or easy bus riding distance. And there is strong evidence that kind of city builds community, vibrancy. People connect to one another. They are invested in one another's success and happiness. And that's a really good social structure. So these ideas came around, and we looked around at, well, where are there experiments like this already going? Well, one is in Humboldt, Kansas. Humboldt, Kansas, tiny town of 1,900 people, happens to be my ancestral home. And it so happens that because of the success of one of my cousins out there in a trailer hitch company, extremely successful, now a company, he invented a new trailer hitch in a barn with his friend of his, 700 people, one of the largest manufacturing companies in that part of Kansas. But he and his children and their friends are revitalizing the downtown. And they have this thing called a Boulder Humboldt. And it's really kind of a real estate and culture and cultural activity play with the idea that why shouldn't people in a small town in Kansas have all the beautiful things that people in larger cities or, like, you know, richer places have. And they've really done that. And the city was featured, the town was featured in the New York Times travel section as one of 52 places to visit in 2022. And it was because they were focusing on places where they're trying to make a difference, where they're trying to revitalize. The idea is something that people like, and not just city, you know, leaders or do-gooders, but just like people who want to live in a place. And I think these are the kind of ideas that have power.
Well, that's a very common problem here in the Midwest, small towns, that even though they might have jobs, the downtown businesses have been Walmartized, you know, with the Walmart outside the edge of town, and you have to figure out what to do with these historic downtowns. And it sounds like they've taken the approach, instead of what can we do to attract people from somewhere else, what can we do to serve our own citizens? And that is a powerful paradigm shift.
Yeah, it is. And I think one of the things that they're trying to do both. They're trying to make it a better place to live for people who live there, by the definition of the people who live there. And they're trying to attract people from the outside. They have some venues that are really, you know, magnetic. I mean, they have a music venue, a beautiful Presbyterian church converted to a music venue with like 250 seats. I mean, it's great. They have a beautiful brew pub they're opening up. They have a beautiful little boutique hotel and other things like that. These are things you don't normally see in the small town in southeastern Kansas. So in order to make them work, they actually have to draw people from elsewhere, at least the tri-state area. And I'll mention Tulsa. This is probably, I'm going to say, an hour and a half drive away. So you might look it up.
Well, let me ask you about some of the other projects. I know Boulder, Colorado, you were talking about water projects. And, of course, in the West, water is an important issue. And it's one that's probably will help define what the West looks like over the next 30 to 50 years. I think there is a pivot project that's looking at how they can best conserve water. The old model was, okay, let's go build a new dam somewhere. That's not necessarily the way things are going to work these days. And so what's going on in Boulder?
Well, one of my nephews is a guy named Andre Ham, my brother John's son. He grew up in Boulder, and he was part of Pivot Projects and still is involved to some extent. And he and some other young guys and women kind of went to Boulder with, wanting to engage with them. And they did engage a bit. But ultimately, what we found was that there was already a very cool project going on in Boulder, just north of Boulder. And in fact, it's run by somebody that Andre has known from childhood. And it's called Drylands Research. And basically, and this is a beautiful model that I think your people in eastern Oklahoma would be interested in, on the approach to the Rocky Mountains is a prairie, and a lot of it was grazing land. A lot of it's suburbs, and a lot of, as you probably saw recently, some of those suburbs burned recently, 1,000 houses. But just north of Boulder, this guy said, we think we can take this degraded prairie, which basically has been described for us by ag people as useless, and we can turn this into a Garden of Eden. And using a lot of kind of soil and land regeneration techniques with a lot of focus on how do you keep the water that falls on this land, and how do you manage it better, they're well on their way to doing that. And it's a combination of good water management, a diversity of plants, of shade trees, of animals to create fertilizer and to break up the soil, which is all part of the process there. And they have a little farm going. And in fact, they have several little agricultural organizations that are all based on regenerative agriculture, now pooling their ideas and pooling together. So that's, I think that's one of the greatest examples I've seen. Another great example of the cellular economy idea. And it's also an example of, Pivot Projects went into a place, with a certain model in mind, but instead, we're helping in other ways. And I think that one of the beautiful things about, when you decide you want to help save the world, is to be really humble. Go into it with a real open mind about, well, I may not have the answer to saving the world, but I can bring my expertise and my creativity and my energies to bear on it. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, that sounds like it's a 180-degree flip from perhaps the initial idea of creating big ideas that would make lots of change to lots of little projects that will make a bit of small change.
Yeah, you call it 1,000 points of light. Remember George Bush Sr. had that? He liked that idea. That's my favorite thing about George Bush Sr. was the idea of 1,000 points of light. I think it's a brilliant idea. And that's Pivot Projects has really embraced that.
Well, let me ask you, a lot of the group's effort was culminating in COP26 in Glasgow. And of course, it was sort of mixed results from that climate summit. And how has that affected the group? I think one of the main takeaways that for many observers is it will be the private sector, not governments, which will be in the driver's seat for, helping to reach net zero emissions at some point in the future. How does that change the emphasis of this grassroots effort?
Well, COP26 was interesting, and a bunch of us went to it, and we had our own kind of event, which was on the bank of the Clyde River right opposite the COP26 venue, and we participated in another one. But, what was clear there was that there were the people inside the gates, the palace gates or the castle gates, and they were government leaders and business leaders. And then there were the people outside the gates, And the people outside the gates were the leaders of nonprofits and grassroots movements and individuals and things like that. And I think my main takeaway from it was there's a lot of distrust of governments, that they're going to make pledges and then not do them, right? And I think it's because people believe that a lot of government leaders are in the pockets of the vested interests. And the vested interests are the interests that want to keep things the way they are, don't want to be disrupted or disturbed. There was a lot of talk by businesses at COP26 about, wanting to be, carbon neutral and blah, blah, blah. And I think I take a lot of them, I say, yes, I'll take, you make that pledge, let's see you do it. But I think the big takeaway is you can't wait around for government and business to solve this problem. We need them, but we as communities and we as individuals have to play our role. There's a super important role for that. I think that's the biggest takeaway. And so I'm urging people everywhere, think about what you could do with others in your community. Is there something already happening that you could join? Are there people that you could come together with? I mean, one of the things that came out of Pivot Projects is something called One Planet. And it's a new model for kind of buying clubs or sharing clubs or investing clubs. It's like all that combined. You've seen co-ops, food co-ops and things like that. But this is like a group of people, maybe 150 families in a place, coming together with similar values to express their values in the economy. And there are, it's the thing is just taking shape right now, but I'm going to bring it to my town. I'm going to bring it to the neighborhood I live in. And I'm also going to bring it to another neighborhood that I don't live in, which is a predominantly Black neighborhood where there is a very strong desire for self-determination and for more success and more vibrancy. And I feel like, this is something that some of my friends in that community might find attractive. So, sometimes you help your own community and sometimes you help your neighbor community. And I want to do both with that model.
The name of the book is The Pivot, Addressing Global Problems Through Local Action. Steve, thanks very much for your time today.
Wonderful talking to you, Rich.
Author, journalist, and filmmaker Steve Hamm speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled The Pivot, Addressing Global Problems Through Local Action. It's published by Columbia University Press. If you want to learn more about the Pivot Project, you can visit their website. It's pivotprojects.org. That's projects with an S for more information. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.